Be the right club. Be the right club today.
Yes! Johnny, that's better than most.
How about him?
That is better than most. Better than most!
Expect anything different?
All right, ladies and gentlemen, welcome back to the No Laying Up podcast. Probably your shortest ever stint between podcast appearances. But I think we saw your last one was to recap your top 100 moments of the year, Mr. Adam Sarson, for 2017. But how many top 100 moments of 2018 happened today alone, Sunday at Bay Hill?
Oh, God. Probably at least three or four, right? I mean, you've got Tiger playing well. You've got Rory just blitzing the entire course. Stenson hit driver off the deck with the driver today. I have no idea, like, off the tee. Like, it was crazy day today.
Bryson saying insane air density on the 18th hole as well.
Oh, my God. Oh, my God. It was so good.
That was, like, intentional, right? Like, he had to know the cameras were on him. And what else did he say? He said something about leverage or something, compression.
I heard air density, and that was it. Like, that's all that mattered to me at that point.
I got too excited. I typoed my tweet with my reaction to that. I don't even care. I got way too excited when he said that. But I legitimately had trouble kind of figuring out whether or not we should start talking with Rory or Tiger, because both stories were so incredibly significant this weekend. But can't be the guy that just ignores the fact that Rory won for the first time. So we can do the whole Rory's back thing, right?
He never left.
No.
Would be my whole thing, right? It's like, I know you and I have talked about this quite a bit before, right? It's like, you know, he didn't win at all in 2017, but there were so many things going on with him between, you know, the injury and then the club changes. You know, he got married too, so like all those things were kind of going on around him. I don't think he was able to actually get settled in at all at any point last season. So, I mean, it kind of made some sense that, you know, he would come out and he played well at the start of the year in the Middle East on the European Tour. Then he had a few hiccups when he came back over stateside. But I mean, this was going to happen. Like, I don't think that there was any doubt in my mind anyway that it was going to happen. I mean, the way that he went up going about it though is what actually shocked me more than anything. I mean, I believe Jake Nicklaus tweeted out that this was the first time in his entire PGA Tour career that he led a tournament in short stroke putting. And I mean, the putter is what got it done. I mean, he got about, I think he averaged what, about 2.5 strokes gained on the green per round this week, which is insane.
It's over if he does that. Like, it's over for absolutely everybody else. I held out for so long on pressing the panic button, and I'm afraid to go back and listen to last week's podcast with Porter.
Oh, you kind of did. You kind of hit the panic button last week.
What did I say? I'm afraid. I don't want to know, actually. I wasn't panicked, but it was like, all right. I was alarmed by how infrequently he was hitting the ball close to the hole. So,
right.
I mean, I wasn't expecting this resurgence in the putting. I mean, I still own real estate on McIlroy Island. There was no.
I
never sold it. Come on. But I was, like, for the first time last week, kind of ready to discuss the fact that he was not playing very well. And I went down there for a few days this week, and I walked a couple holes with him on Tuesday, kind of like easing into it, like, man, like, what's going on? And he could not have been less concerned. To me at the time, he obviously hadn't won yet. To me, it was kind of like, all right, like he's telling himself that he's still there, blah, blah, blah. But he was totally not concerned, totally confident. And he actually, like, picked right before he went to that practice round, he picked up like some kind of tip from Pete Cowan on the range and was like putting it into action. And then went out and striped the ball this week, led the field in driving distance, proximity to the hole, and then got, of course, the well documented putting tip now from Brad Faxon, and led the field in strokes gained putting. So it was going to be a quiet year, hype-wise, leading up for him to the Masters. Probably the most quiet since, you know, he had a chance to make this the career Grand Slam. But I don't think that's going to be the case anymore.
No, I mean, look, I think it was Brendan Porath tweeted something out. I believe it was actually just a photo of a text message he had sent with him and Kyle Porter going back on. And Kyle had mentioned that it seemed like Rory was kind of flying under the radar a little bit this week. And he was right. I mean, you know, everyone is obviously talking about Tiger and how things were going to kind of play out this week with him. Yeah, I don't know. It's strange. I mean, with Rory, he's so good that, like, you know, the struggling is something that I don't really give any credence to be perfectly honest. There's probably anywhere from, say, 10 to 15 players in the world where it's just like, okay, you know what? You probably shouldn't worry about them. Rory's one of those guys. Spieth's one of those guys. To your point, though, it's like, you know, look at Henrik Stenson this week too, right? Stenson's also one of those guys that when he's putting well, he's almost unstoppable. And Rory's the best example of that. I mean, I can't imagine that kind of red hot putter is going to continue going forward. But I mean, not at least at the level that it did this week, because that would be insane. But I mean, if he can putt anywhere near that way, I mean, he's going to win 4 or 5 times this year without question.
I mean, he started slow today. He was even through 5, then birdied 6, 7, 9, 13, 14, 15, 16, and 18. Like, he needed he needed to finish in that fury, though. Like, that this leaderboard was nearly unfair. It looked like a WGC leaderboard.
Oh yeah. And yeah, no, it was crazy.
It didn't happen for Stenson today, which I generally root for Stenson, but there was so much other stuff going on behind him that I'm definitely not thrilled about it, but I was kind of like, all right, we needed something. I was obviously pulling for Tiger the most, and then when Tiger went OB, I was like, okay, it's Rory's time now. And then he chips in on 15, his routine birdie on 16, which is a joke. He had 119 into a par 5 on the PGA Tour.
Was it 373 off the tee? I mean, yeah. he carried that bunker with such ease that I don't know. It seems unfair when he's going to be hitting the ball that far.
But I mean, so the causes for concern with Rory were real, and that he'd fallen out of the top 10 in the world for like the first time since I think 2009. Which first yeah. one can we point to the absurdity of that? That's such a we just take him for granted in that regard, and it's kind of amazing. I don't know, that amazed me that he never even fell outside the top 10 during 2013. During that, I mean, he was number one player in the world in 12, so maybe that's how he just kind of held onto that ranking for that long. But that kind of stat amazed me. But
look, it's a testament to, like, you know, all the times that, you know, we talked about the you know, when he was changing equipment back and forth for the last few years, you know, he never fell out. You know, there's always so much talk about, he hasn't won a major in a few years, and he hasn't done this and he hasn't done that. And then it's like, yeah, well, you know what? He still goes out and he wins tournaments. And then on top of that, you know, he places really high in a lot of those big events too. So, I mean, his consistency is something that we really don't talk enough about, to be perfectly honest.
How ironic is it that he, like, never used to play this event, and Arnie wanted him to play it so badly? And this is only his fourth time playing. Or I don't even know. He started playing, I think, in 2015. And I was talking to him about it, and it's like, this course should be pretty good for you. He's like, oh, his eyes lit up. He's like, oh, yeah. Like, this is, you know, they have those, like, 4 par 5s like that he can just easily take advantage of. It's good to see. I mean, what did you think? Did you put any credence to his comments he made about alcohol sales on the PGA Tour? Do you think he's going to catch any flack for that?
I mean, he's going to catch some flack, I guess, from some people. But I mean, does he have a point? I mean, he might. It'll never happen. I mean, the tour, obviously. I mean, they made too much money. Everyone makes too much money off of alcohol sales. But I mean, it'll never change. But I mean, you could definitely make an argument for it. I mean, especially if Tiger's going to be any kind of resurgent player going forward. I mean, it's just going to bring out even more people, and you know, you're obviously going to get your fair share of people who can't control themselves when they don't drink, let alone when they do. So, he does have a bit of a point, but I mean, unfortunately, it'll definitely never change.
Well, so apparently there was somebody following him Saturday, like yelling his wife's name at him during his entire round. And
oh God,
yeah. So I started thinking about this, and in that it seems to be a theme. I mean, more and more players are speaking out on just fan behavior, and I think you can get a bit lost in what the issue actually is, right? I mean, a lot of people are going to, you know, tune all this out and say, those are the guys that pay their salary, they pay a ticket, they can go do and say what they want. As long as they're not yelling in your swing, it's fine. I just think, like, with it, the new policy on cell phones now, and that you can basically shoot video and do whatever you want with your cell phone, that people are getting they're able to capture themselves saying something dumb at a player for laughs and put it on social media. That almost this, like, combination of the policy and, you know, this kind of resurgence and huge crowds following Tiger and all this is doubling down, and now people have, like, an even more incentive to yell something dumb at a player because they can document it and show all their friends how funny they are. Do you think there's anything to that?
Everybody's in the content making business. You know, everyone's trying to create their own content these days. No, that is for sure. I mean, that's probably part of it. I mean, you remember the big thing that happened last year at the President's Cup? Was it Mark Leishman's wife, and then Audrey's her name, made that big post on her blog that kind of blew up, where she was just like, you know what, this is kind of ridiculous. You know, that, you know, the things that are being said on the golf course these days that, you know, that players and that their families are hearing has gone too far. And it's not, and this is not an American versus, you know, Canadian versus European versus whoever kind of thing. Like it exists everywhere. But I don't know what they're going to be able to do about it. I mean, aside from kicking people out, and which, I mean, they probably should do more of, you're never going to be able to stop it.
Yeah, I don't think they're going to be able to stop it, but I don't know what the answer is. But I think I just find it interesting that players are starting to really speak out on it and willing to maybe take some of the even the abuse for it. Because, I mean, yeah, I don't think fans aren't going to like hearing players complain about, oh, you millionaire pampered pros and all that, which there's something to that. But at the same time, like if they feel like it's affecting their performance in the workplace, that's their it's where they, you know, are making a living, then I feel like it's justified to at least say something. So.
Well, I mean, remember when Rory a couple weeks ago said that it feels like, you know, that he feels like Tiger loses, what, half a stroke around just based on all the craziness that goes on around him. I mean, somebody like him or JT, I think that was when he said it, when they played at Riv together, you know, they're probably not as bothered by it. But like somebody like Sam Burns, who played with him a few weeks ago, or even Bud Cauley today, who's been on tour for a while. Like, I mean, you have to wonder how much it's going to affect them too, right? Tiger, not so much, I don't think, at this point, but the other guys, I mean, it has to take a toll on them as well.
Yeah, and I mean, there's going to be, if this continues this way, there's going to be huge crowds out there, especially on Sunday, following that guy in red, which we made it over 10 minutes without really talking about him yet. all I can say is there were some shots hit today on this Sunday that caused simultaneous like orgasm sounds in the kill house. Like there was a trage. he felt it
in your loins.
No, there was just, he hit, like when he hit the stinger, I forget which hole that was on. It was
it was 11, just off the tee at 11.
It was a sound that reverberated through this house. We got off the couch on some of these shots that, man, how aggressive was he out there today? I mean,
oh my God.
When he pulled driver on 5, which is a hole he's hit iron on every day so far this week, I was like, okay, something's kind of different about this run. He's actually really going for it today, trying to get as close to that green as possible and chip up and make another birdie. And the line he took off the tee on 6, man, this to me, people were expecting him to play well this week, considering he finished in second place last week, and he's had so much success at Bay Hill. But this to me was even more impressive than the second place finish at Valspar. Is that a fair take?
The only negative, I guess, the only thing I would say about that would be, I mean, you know, if he's done so well here, right? I mean, he knows the course so well that, like, going to Valspar, where he hadn't played in, what, 22 years? Like, he hadn't seen Copperhead in that long? Like, that would be the only thing that I would say that Copperhead was probably a little more impressive than Bay Hill. But, I mean, it was just the quality of the shots today, the things that he pulled off. I mean, even yesterday, I'm not sure if you saw, but the bunker shot that he hit on, I think it was on the back nine, it might have been 16, where he basically had to, he was up near the lip, and he had to get it over the lip, through the trees and over the water and then onto the back of the green, like it from like about 200 yards out. Like, these are the shots that I think you can attest to the fact that, you know, there were several people, like I can say that I was one of the people who thought that he was going to be okay if he got healthy, but I never thought I'd see this again, not the way that he's doing it. Like I don't think that it's a stretch to say that I never thought that we'd see somebody like him hit these shots again.
I mean, he's not totally perfect. Like he's not totally back in that regard, but he's so much further along than we could have even imagined that it's kind of scary to think how much better he can get. Cause today honestly looked like a different gear. And I know he lost steam. We'll get to the back nine, but it was like a different gear where he wasn't necessarily playing at the fat side of the green. He's been so tactical with everything he's done in this comeback, and he's done as much as he struggled off the tee, he's done well hitting irons off tee and laying back and just being, you know, not making big mistakes. And that's kind of, I don't want to say that's going to lead to a lot of top tens and not a lot of wins, but that doesn't surprise me that he's, you know, not making a ton of big numbers, not making a ton of bogeys, and, you know, had a couple finishes in the top five but hasn't won. Today he dialed it up a notch and was going for the win. I don't think he cared what he finished. He made that run on the back nine and got up to 16, which is a hole he has dominated his career. He missed right all three times the first three rounds and then just pulled one OB. Like, are you kidding me?
Oh, my God. I mean, part of me was just like, oh, man, you know, if this was Phil, like, he'd find a sprinkler head under there somewhere and he would basically say that it wasn't actually OB. But, like, it was, you know, that's the one thing, though, right? It's like the struggles off the tee are still the thing, you know, like it's not like I wasn't actually all that worried about him coming out and having the yips around the greens. I think the last time we saw him, like, he kind of had those resolved. I mean, his short game has been way better than I thought it was going to be. And the putter has been incredible. But yeah, the driver needs to sort that out. I mean, if he's gonna make a run somewhere, I think. I mean, aside from going, I mean, look, if he wants to go tee it up at the Deer or the Travelers or wherever, I think those are great places for him to just, you know, smash those two irons off the tee. If he needs to sort out the driver. But with that said, like, we're still so early into this whole thing. I mean, he's playing so much better than anyone expected. Like, just need to give him a little bit of time. And I mean, there's no suggestion that he can't figure it out, especially at these places that he knows so well.
Yeah, just I'm a bit concerned in that he won't be able to hit as many two irons at Augusta, right? And
oh yeah, no, that's true. I mean, he does need the longer clubs there. So I mean, he'll need to figure it out before he goes there.
And Augusta is infinitely more demanding off the tee now than it once was, but it's still not the most demanding. And having to, I literally just said he won't be hitting that many, you know, two irons off the tee, but I don't think he needs to hit a ton of drivers there. A lot of those par fours, I've always said that it's not that much of an advantage to come into them from 130 yards versus 160. So I want to see him get the three wood figured out the most. I still don't think he needs a ton of drivers around that place. And if he can find the fairway with the three wood, he's hitting the ball so far right now. He's still going to be hitting it past where a lot of guys are hitting their driver.
Yeah.
I went out there and followed him on Thursday. That's my first time I've ever gotten to follow him inside the ropes. I mean, which is kind of crazy considering that, you know, like, well, basically when we started this thing, it was 2014. He's been terrible ever since. The timing of this thing couldn't have been worse, really. And I got to follow him some as a kid around Muirfield and whatnot, but it was always so hard to see. And I actually got a first chance to watch him play all 68 shots or whatever he played on Thursday. And it was awesome to watch, but it was amazing just to see in person how it doesn't look like he's swinging that hard or any harder than who he's playing with, and he's blowing it past Jason Day and Hideki Matsuyama, like blowing it past him with iron. Matsuyama hit three wood, or maybe it was five wood on 11 on Thursday morning. It's 8:45 in the morning, 44 degrees, and Kat just flips a two iron out there 275 yards. I mean, he didn't even lash at it. And just that true command he has of the ball with his irons was something to behold. And it just, I don't know. I got pretty sentimental last week on the podcast about just the whole experience and everything. But, man, it's fun to see him, like, having fun out there. And when he drained that super long birdie on 7, his 16th hole on Thursday, he couldn't wipe the smile off his face. Like, he was writing, like, he laughed all the way up to the cup, and while he's writing his score on his scorecard, he was, like, still smirking. He couldn't wipe it off. And it's so, I've always been so impressed by his ability to shut other people out and not pay attention to them. But he was kind of interacting with fans every now and then. He gave a fist bump to a girl on the way to the third tee, which he probably shouldn't have done because he promptly hit it OB after that. But
well, you know, it's funny because Johnny on the broadcast today too, like he said, he's like, you know, something about how important it was to smile on the golf course and how Tiger, you know, how he hasn't done this since he was a kid. And I mean, I was sitting here thinking to myself, I was like, well, you know, he did pretty well without the smiling thing for quite a while. But, you know, I mean, it does, it's a good thing. It's good to see him out there having more fun. The weird thing about all the distance stuff, too, I mean, I was reading somewhere else a few days ago that somebody had asked him, you know, like, are you surprised that you're hitting the ball this far? Like, can you explain it? And he basically said that he couldn't explain it. So, like, I don't know how it's, he doesn't even know how it's happening. to be honest, and it seems like. And I mean, it's kind of crazy that we're at that point with him in the distance. I mean, he's going to be able to compete at some places, like we already kind of talked about, without the driver. But, you know, once he gets that, if he can get that figured out, I mean, we could be seeing something that I don't think you and I ever expected.
Well, what is great about the distance is what it allows him to do off the tee and not to rely on the driver, right? Because he can hit that two iron so far and so consistently that that's, you know, I think some people are, you know, concerned by how hard he's swinging it and how far he's hitting it and how, you know, that means he's going to, you know, get into more trouble with the driver. But I think it's the opposite. I think it's he can get away with two iron, eight iron around so many golf courses that and he kind of he's always made his schedule out really well to courses that he's been able to do that on. If you're in need of a lightweight golf bag, look no further than the OG Osiris. I am currently using this exact bag, and if you're not using the latest technology in a golf bag, it can make the 4 hours on the golf course pretty unbearable. I love it. It's lightweight. It's easy to carry. It's comfortable on your shoulders, and at the same time, it has an endless amount of pocket space. Jackets, gloves, snacks, cold drinks, the Cirrus has you covered. OGO is the leader in golf bag design. They continue to pump out great products, including this Cirrus stand bag. Check out all the products at OGO.com and use the promo code NOLAYINGUP. That's no spaces, no laying up at checkout, and you'll save 20% on your entire order from now through the end of April. It's a pretty good deal. That's OGO.com, OGIO.com with promo code NOLAYINGUP. Let's get back to Adam Sarson. So yeah, I mean, I still go back to, you know, 2015 at the Masters when he was all over the place and injured and nobody knew what was up, and he had been sculling the ball around Scottsdale, and that was the height of the chipping yips, and he showed up and I forget what he finished.
He hit those balls into the stands on purpose.
Oh, that's right. Like, that's right. I forgot about that take. and he was in the third to last group on Sunday with Rory, and it was like, so I just will never forget that, and never been less confident in his game, and he was able to scrape together for that Masters. He's able to do it the year after the car accident. You know, he didn't even play leading up to it, and he finished tied fourth, I think. He gets around that golf course. I know he hasn't won there in 13 years, but he knows how to get the ball around that golf course. So I'd be very surprised if he doesn't finish top 10 at Augusta.
Yeah, I mean, look, I mean, we've seen this. It's Luden Tiger, right? I mean, we've seen this for years at that place, that for whatever reason, you know, players like, you know, Fred Couples is always a guy that everyone talks about, right? About how, you know, every year Couples seems to be on Saturday, you know, he gets onto the first page of the leaderboard, and you're wondering how the hell he does it, because he's, you know, he's playing only on the Champions Tour, and he doesn't really show up any other week of the year on the PGA Tour. I mean, you know, Bernhard Langer, you know, was in the second to last group on Sunday, what was it, 2 years ago, mm-hmm. something like that? Like, these things happen, right? And I mean, for whatever reason, you need experience to win and to play well at Augusta. I mean, there's no doubt in my mind that both Tiger and Phil are going to be playing well at Augusta at some point into their 50s, assuming that they're healthy, right? I mean, it's just the way it goes with them. So, I mean, you're right. I mean, I would be surprised if he didn't finish inside the top 10. I don't know if I'm willing to go much further than that at this point, but yeah, I'd be shocked if he didn't finish inside the top 10.
I just want to point to the absurdity of even like if 14 days ago, if you'd have told me we were talking about Tiger like competing for the title at Augusta, I'd have said, all right,
good. He's the favorite. He's the betting favorite.
Which makes sense to me. It does. It makes total sense when you consider how well he's played and how the books have to protect themselves against the Tiger bettors. That does not seem absurd to me, which is, it usually does, but it does not right now.
Does today's win by Rory adjust that in any way?
I mean, I think obviously Rory's odds are going to come down, but I don't think Rory. Yeah. I don't think Rory becomes the favorite. Yeah. No, I don't think it'll change it too much. I tweeted this story too, but I thought like the coolest moment that I got to see in person Thursday was he was off early 8:30. He finished his round around one. And a lot of guys were there on the range warming up for the afternoon wave, and at Bay Hill, when you come off the ninth green, you have to walk through the range to get back to the clubhouse to sign your card and whatnot. And, I mean, the crowds, as you might imagine, were overflowing. He comes up onto this, and everyone's cheering him as he just made a 15-foot par putt on 18 to shoot 68. And they're cheering him coming through the walkway, and he gets up on the range. And, like, everyone that was – all the crowd that was at the range watching stood up and started cheering for him, like, walking through. And it just reverberated. Almost every single player turned and stopped hitting balls and turned to watch it. Like, you couldn't ignore it. Like, it was a very real kind of salute, and it was such a cool. I just don't think that happens with any other player that walks through the back of the range, that they stop and watch a guy walk through. But I just thought that was so cool to see.
So what was it? I mean, you were there the first couple of days. I mean, what was it like to be inside the ropes, just kind of following around, like in terms of the crowds and the other player reactions to it?
I mean, I was there on a Thursday morning, so even that front nine was not overflowing. The noise wasn't, you know, it wasn't like a Friday afternoon crowd. You know, it was just a good size, obviously way bigger for a normal Thursday morning round than you would in anyone else on the golf course, but it wasn't insane. But by that time the afternoon came around and he made that huge putt on seven. Yeah. I mean, it was, you kind of just take it for granted that having that level of access and getting to see it, but that's what I was trying super hard not to, because knowing I'd never gotten to see this before. And I would go, like, nobody goes back to the 16th tee to watch, guys, because it's so far back compared to where you enter the hole. I went back there. Right. I was like, I don't get this opportunity to ever see something like this. So I getting to watch him play shots up close. And I was so impressed with the control he had with the irons and the trajectory of the shots. And I don't fear, it's weird. Like, in person, I wasn't fearing his driver miss nearly as bad as I do watching on TV. It doesn't feel... He feels closer to having that figured out than it feels like on TV, if that makes any sense. I'm not sure that it does.
Well, I mean, I was on Twitter, so I guess, yeah, tonight at some point, I believe Alan Shipnuck was talking about how, like, you know, he was watching him on the range, like, he's striping it on the range, and then when he takes it to the course, for whatever reason, like, he just can't keep it in play. And I was just, I don't know what that is, if it's something in his head, if it's something, like, it's bizarre. I mean, it leads me to believe, though, that it's there and that he'll figure it out at some point. I mean, now that he's fully healthy, that's always been my number one concern. But it seems kind of bizarre to me that, you know, if it's true that he's striping it on the range constantly, that he can't seem to take that to the course.
What's amazing is how palpable the excitement was when he is standing on the 16th tee box, one shot back. And he finished eight shots behind Rory. How insane was that finish by Rory? Like,
oh my God. Oh my God. Well, like, that's the thing, right? I mean, that's why everybody says, you know, that when, you know, for the most part, when he's on, when he has that whole, like, you know, whose A game is best, it's like, it's probably his. Like, you know, as much as I hate that argument, as much as I hate having that conversation, because all of these guys are so good, it's a run that you see, like the one that he put on today on the back nine, that makes you go, yeah, you know, he's probably the best player in the world. And sometimes a day like today makes it think like it's not even all that close.
Yeah, I wish we'd see it more often. Hopefully this is a sign that we will see it continually more often. But that I'm sure that this comparison's been made, but it felt a bit like 2010 at Quail Hollow when he shot final round 62. Yeah. I think that was his first win, actually, on the PGA Tour. So that was it's good to see. Man, I don't know. I feel like every year before the Masters, we get a lot of questions like, who would you like to see, whatever. And then we all do these fantasies of, oh, I'd love it if Rory and Tiger came down the stretch. It's like, dude, we kind of get whatever we want now in golf. Like, why can't we get that?
It there's no reason why we can't get that. If you told me right now that the final three groups in a few weeks were going to be some combination of Tiger, Rory, Spieth, Phil, DJ and JT, I'd be like, yeah, that makes a lot of sense. I can totally see that happening. It's a crazy thing to think about, but that's exactly what we could get. And I mean, it's like I said, it's crazy to think about, but it's true. It could absolutely happen.
One thing I was thinking about while watching Tiger out there was, you know, and again, I was quite sentimental last week, and looking at it from a different perspective, think of like the most embarrassing things that you could have happen to you. Like, I could think of maybe like six horribly embarrassing things that if they happened to me would be very shameful, and Tiger's had like four of them happen. So imagine he does. I mean, some of it is on himself, but like, obviously the scandal, like, that was horrific to go through. Then to have like your text messages all over the internet, your voicemails, then to get a DUI, your nudes leaked. Like, look at the combination of all the things that guy has put up with in the last 10 years. Again, some of it is his own doing, but at the same time, like, that the shame of each of those things would be enough to make somebody just become a recluse and not want to ever be seen in public again. Well, and he faces all that.
Well, and then on top of that, too, I mean, obviously these things aren't as important. This isn't as important as the ones that you just mentioned, but, like, the fact that he came back and he looked like your regular, you know, he didn't look like a tour player when he came back for the last few years. And, like, you know, when he had he was very clear that he had the yips for a while. You know, that round that I believe you might have been up watching at the time, I can't recall. I know myself and Porath were up watching it, the one from the Middle East where he pulled out and, you know, he said that he, you know, we all believe that he probably hurt himself on the flight over at some point last year, but, like, he looked like an absolute wreck. Like, he basically flubbed a putt from off the green. You know, like he was struggling to get in and out of bunkers. Like it was one of those things where, like, he didn't look like a regular player. And, you know, that's embarrassing for any PGA Tour player, let alone the guy that many of us think is the best player of all time. So, you know, you throw that into the mix with all the other stuff that you just mentioned. And yeah, you know what? It really, I know you and Kyle kind of talked about this last week, but, you know, the perseverance that it's taken for him to get back to this point is actually pretty remarkable. Even, you know, I'm sure that, like you said, some people would say, well, you know, it's a lot of that stuff was self-inflicted, but it's like, yeah, okay, that's true. But, like, he did come back and he looks as good as he's looked in, God, at least 5 years and potentially even more than that.
Yeah. I mean, it was kind of amazing to watch it today and how not routine it felt, but normal and not unusual. Like, last week felt unusual. It was like, all right, is this happening? And now when he made the run at it today, just how last week I kind of still refused to believe it. And this week was, I could have totally seen him birdieing out and cause he had to hit that ball, OB. His comments about it to Sanzi, which was fantastic also.
Sanzi.
I thought it was great. That answer was one of the best interview answers he's ever given. He's like,
I thought it was very honest. Right? He was very honest.
He said he had like three different shots he could have played. I didn't commit to it. I wanted to play a fade, and then I stood over it and said, why don't you just bomb one right over it? And I didn't play the right shot. And he smiled about it. And he's just kind of like, yep, you know what? I learned from that, and I need to commit to the shot. That was because he had a 124 in with his second drive. Like,
I know. Well, that was the thing, and he stepped up right after that, and he smashed the next one right down the middle. So it's like, yeah, you know what? It's there. You're right. I thought that was you're right. It was one of the best answers I think I've ever seen him give to a question that, you know, I think previously he probably would have said something else, but I mean, you know, he was very honest.
It's good to hear. It's good to also know that it didn't matter because Rory was going to win this. And, you know, if that was the shot that decided it, that OB ball, then it would have been a lot harder to stomach all that. So 71st in strokes gained off the tee this week. The OB balls will do that to you. And that's four shots just off the bat. 19th in strokes gained approaching, second in strokes gained around the green, eighth in putting. Unreal.
It really is. I mean, like I said, I wasn't worried about the yips coming back, but the way that he's pitching and chipping everything around the greens is actually, it's very reminiscent of what we used to see. So, I'm not terrified for him to go to Augusta in a couple of weeks and see all those tight lies around the place. So, I can't wait to see what he does in the next couple of weeks.
Bridging one of our favorite topic to talk about. We literally talk about the Ryder Cup every time you're on with another guy that was on the leaderboard today. I don't think I had him in my 12. I definitely didn't have him in my 12, and I don't even think I'm had him on the outside looking in when I talked to Porter last week about the Ryder Cup team. Grayson
Murray?
we'll stay away from that one, and let's talk about the mad scientist, the artist in France. I can picture this.
So back in 2016, so I do like these Ryder Cup forecasting posts on my site, like usually once every couple of months. And back around the time of the Masters where, you know, he contended and he was looking like the real deal, I started to mention him in those posts and I was like, you know, I can actually see this. And I think, if I'm not mistaken, I believe you did something similar around that time as well, correct?
Mine was worse. I said before he made his first professional start, I was like, guys, just like be patient with him, all right? Either if he plays too well or, you know, plays horribly, like let's just give him time. And he finished T4 at Harbortown and I said, okay, let's start talking about the Ryder Cup because he might be on the team. So, I didn't last a week. I got too excited.
He led the field that week at Harbortown in strokes gained tee to green, if I recall.
He mashed.
And like... Yeah, it was incredible. 2 weeks in a row, he looked every bit the player that we thought he might look in 2 or 3 years, you know. And it looked very legitimate. I don't know, like, I can absolutely see it happening. Like, it was funny. Like, I jokingly tweeted about it yesterday. And, of course, as I'm sure you would expect, like, the responses I got back were, no, you're crazy. Why would you do that? Whatever. Like, he's not a Ryder Cup player. I disagree entirely. Like, I think he is a Ryder Cup player. I'm not saying he's going to be there, but, like, you can absolutely see it. I mean, he mashes the ball off the tee. You know, can you imagine putting him with Phil in a Ryder Cup? Like, just as a pairing, the two of them, and just letting them try to dissect the golf course, it would be magic to watch.
So that's what I kind of want to know, in that, you know, us outsiders, we can look at all this stuff, look at the standings, look at, you know, this guy would be a great match play player, but you don't necessarily weigh in enough of what matters, and that it's going to be hard to take him with a captain's pick when you're not a popular player and you're a rookie. It's got to be very hard, I would imagine, to become a captain's pick. So in that regard, you mentioned Phil. I think they play some practice rounds together. I don't know what the extent of their relationship is, but I think it would take someone like Phil advocating for him to get picked before it would actually become a reality. Is that fair?
Probably. I mean, so I was thinking about this earlier too. Like, my thought was that he would probably have to make the team outright. And the reason I would say that is like, you already have, you know, some of these guys that are on, and granted, it's only March, we're still so early, but like, there's no way that players like Patrick Reed and Phil and whoever, these guys that you might suspect might be towards the end of the roster, at least on the bubble, maybe not Phil after the win, but like they're not going to leave Ricky at home. Right, they're not going to leave Patrick Reed at home. They're probably not going to leave Matt Kuchar at home either. So he might have to make the team outright, because those other guys are always going to be in front of him in terms of getting a captain's pick. You know, you never know how somebody like Jim Furyk might try to run a roster. Right, I mean, someone like Xander Schauffele or Patrick Cantlay, you know, might end up being on the outside looking in because of reasons X, Y, and Z. Right, I mean, the Furyk might think that Zach Johnson is good because he's a veteran and he needs somebody else like that on a relatively young roster. Who knows what Bert's Kepta status is going to be, depending on how he gets back from the wrist injury, things like that, right? So I think you're right. I think it kind of makes sense that unless he makes it outright, he's going to have somebody advocating for him to get there.
Do we know what Kepka's status is, by the way? Have you heard anything on this? I've lost track of it. Is he going to play in the Masters?
I have no idea. I haven't explicitly looked it up. I suppose I can look it up, but I mean, I haven't heard anything. The last I heard was that he was still recovering from the wrist.
I think it was going to be 8 to 10 weeks when he initially went out, but I don't remember it being much of a story that he was going to miss the first major of the year. It's so quickly forgotten, just among the people just kind of ignore that he's probably one of the five best American players in the world, and he's people don't even talk about him now that he's hurt and whatnot, but I don't know. We'll see.
Well, I mean, right now he's third in the point standings, right? So, I mean, he's got a little bit of buffer, but I mean, if he doesn't come back, I mean, the guys are going to start passing him. So
yeah, he's got all the points from the US Open last year, I think is what helped him there. But no, you mentioned Cantlay. I mean, we talked about him some, and Schauffele. Have you looked at much into what the European team's going to look like? Because Job wrote for our site a piece this week that looks into kind of some of the storylines going on with the picks. It's fascinating because in his he made like essentially a group of locks based on, you know, how he sees the season playing out, and, you know, obviously some guys with experience and where they people rank in the world ranking. And he doesn't have Paul Casey in there. And I was like, as soon as I read it, I was like, dude, come on, Paul Casey's going to be on the team. And he started explaining it to me, and I was like, he might not. He might not, because of how, you know, like Fitzpatrick and Hatton are locked in from a world ranking standpoint, and all these crazy factors that are going in. It's really, really interesting. So have you dug into it? Is it crazy to think that Paul Casey might not be on the team?
I think that's a little crazy. I did not read Job's piece yet. I had it open today, and I just didn't get to it. But that seems a little far-fetched to me. You know, like,
he's going to address that in version two. He's going to have a part two, I think, and just kind of talk about it. But when he started talking about the world ranking, that's when I was like, oh, yeah, you're right. Like, yeah, Hatton is definitely going to be on there because of world ranking. Oh, yeah, Fitzpatrick definitely will because of world ranking. And I was like, well, what's Paul Casey's world ranking? How is he not on there? But right. It's a weird system how they've kind of redone the system essentially so Paul Casey can play on the team. So I would be I would be very shocked if he's not on it.
Given given that Thomas Bjorn and I believe Darren Clark even before that for 2016 were adamant about reaching out to players. Not it wasn't just Paul Casey. I believe in 2016, if I'm not mistaken, I believe Clark was also talking to players like David Lane Murth and whatever, and trying to get them to come back and play a little bit more so that they could still be eligible, right? So, I mean, given that they've made that much effort to get Casey, you know, to get him back over there, I don't think that that's... It would be very strange to me that he wouldn't make the team. Just anecdote, like, again, without having read Job's piece, my thought would be that they already have like nine locks on the roster, right? So it's Rom, Rose, Sergio, Fleetwood, Casey, Rory, Hatton, Stenson, and Norin. Like, I'm pretty sure those nine are there. And then outside of that, you know, you've got a lot of really good players between Cabrera Bayo and Fitzpatrick, Molinari. I wouldn't like Poulter is kind of there lingering as well. He's back in the match play next week for the first time in a few years. So it's going to be a stout team for sure.
Yeah, it's crazy. It's going to be super interesting who like first guy out on that team is. I hadn't even thought about Poulter. I know his play of recent years is not nearly up to his standard of his prime and his Ryder Cup, but it's hard to ignore that guy's Ryder Cup record. And I don't know. I think it'd take a lot for him to actually make the team. But I hadn't even thought of him, but oh, there's so much golf to be played, so much. And we tossed around some names, and like Patton Kazire's name came up. The record was like, all right, that's our sign that there's a lot more golf to be played. But it's what we're going to do, and we're going to keep an eye on it, keep gauging it. What did you think of – it's good to – well, let me ask. Was it good to have Johnny Miller back in your life today?
Absolutely. Right? Look, there were some tweets going around today about how he was a little rusty and he didn't have his best stuff today. And it's like, hey, you know what? Sometimes he doesn't have his fastball. Like, we know that this is a thing that's happened over the last few years. For me though, I was actually saying this to my brother the other day. The thing about Miller is that I actually used to just, I couldn't stand listening to him. Because, I mean, I always just thought that he was ridiculous. He was over the top. He was too difficult on the players. Basically, he forgot how hard it is to actually play the game at this level is what I always used to think. But now I'm all in on him because he's actually so ridiculous that he's a caricature of what he was, right? I mean, he's so entertaining. He's so over the top that I find it hard to not enjoy having him on the call. You know, the whole NBC crew just does such a really good job all week. I mean, I still feel like they're not using Faraday in the way that they should. I don't know what that is necessarily, but it feels like they're not utilizing him properly. But otherwise, no, it was great to have Johnny back in the booth this week.
I shouldn't forget that Faraday's on the broadcast, and that's what happens almost every week. I'm like, oh yeah, that's right. Yeah. They have David Faraday. They should probably use him more. I think it's totally fine to disagree with a lot of what Johnny says and still be appreciative for what he is. And that, like, if you're I don't know. If give me Faldo or Johnny Miller with color commentary, it's not even. I don't know who you want with color commentary more than you would want Johnny. I mean, it's okay. He said some things we all laugh at, and I think he said Rory had nitrous oxide in his muscles or something today. Like, what are you talking about? Nobody knows. But like, at the same time, if I'm talking and I hear Johnny talking, like if I'm in the room talking, I shut up to make sure I hear what he says because he says things that are worth listening to. Again, not always right, and some might get on your nerves, but man, we should be appreciative. And not a popular take on Twitter. I was excited to have Johnny in there today, and everyone's like, wait, why are you saying Johnny's the worst announcer? My man.
No.
I don't get it.
He's great. I mean, look, from an inside standpoint, I think he's been passed by Gary Koch on the NBC broadcast, and then Gary Koch is really good. I still think Paul Azinger is the best guy out there. I know I've said this to you and to some other people in our chat that we have, but Fox to me still does the best job of any of the people who broadcast golf. And a lot of it is because of how good Azinger is, but no, Miller's just fine. I enjoy having him back. It always feels like a big event when he's there. I just wish that they would, you know, figure out a way to better utilize Faraday. That's all.
But it's amazing too that we can say that Fox maybe is the best at covering golf, considering how bad they were that first year and how hard we were were on them. So it comes from a place of love when we're critical. But
absolutely,
too many. I don't have the counter on them. We didn't time it all, but man, too many commercials today. That was tough. I don't know. It's too late for this year. I know that like they do all this stuff. So much stuff is planned out so far in advance and all that. But man, they've got to get something figured out on the commercial front. It loses so much rhythm. It's and I think that's more of a tour problem than it is an NBC or CBS problem.
Yeah, I think it probably is as well. I mean, then like on top of that too, like they're always this week is always a little more different because of all the Arnold Palmer stuff, which is fine. It's completely justified to have a lot of focus on them. But yeah, when you combine that with all the commercials, which is a big deal. I mean, it just you're right. It loses a lot of flow.
I struggle with my balance on the Arnie thing, knowing Arnie is not of my generation. I didn't get to see him play, and he didn't have the same effect on me as he's obviously had on so many people. So my perspective really means kind of nothing on it from that regard. But I understand that I'm one of the, you know, whatever percent of people that are tuning in and watching the entire broadcast. So I see the Arnie stuff repeatedly. But every year it does always feel like, man, we're doing another one, like another segment, like another one. Like,
yeah,
we all know that how high of a regard he's held in and how much people appreciate him and all the wonderful stories about him. I just don't know if, you know, Sunday we need to cut to Jimmy Roberts and Peter Jacobson in a room telling a couple stories about Arnie. It's like, I don't know.
Especially given the leaderboard that we had today and the way it was all. I mean, if it's five guys on the top of the leaderboard that people might not necessarily want to watch, that's one thing. But no, you're right. It's a tough balancing act, right? I mean, they have to pay a lot of tribute to him because it's justified. It's completely justified.
And people tune in because it's Arnie's tournament. It's not like people, not necessarily from our generation, but definitely people do. And at the same time, if somebody tunes in to watch the last hour and they didn't see the three previous segments, like, yeah, you need to show them something related to Arnie. So I get all that. But I will say I got to play in the Pro-Am on Wednesday with Sam Saunders. That was such a thrill. It really was. It was so cool. Really? He is such a class act. Obviously, we talked about Arnie and all the effects he's had on his life, and the kid just totally gets it. He just is so appreciative of everything he's been given. He takes everything in stride. It's such a busy week. He's got speaking engagements, and it's just mayhem. And he couldn't have handled things with more class. He's out there directing traffic, picking out lines for us, reading putts, and signing every single autograph. Going out of his way to take pictures with people. It's probably his busy. And I know he doesn't get that necessarily everywhere he goes, and it's his week to really get it from growing up in the area and all that. But he handled it so well. It was such a blast to play with him. It was an honor. Honestly, it was like that. That was one of the coolest golf experiences I've had. So,
did you see any of the early Golf Channel coverage today? Because he was doing some of the he was in the booth for a bit.
I missed this. How was it?
He was really good. And like. And I believe it was Steve Sands at the time who had said, you basically, as he was signing off, he's like, you have a career in this if you really want to at some point. Like, he was really good. It was nice to hear. Because like you said, he has a different perspective than a lot of the other players too. But, he was really great on the air. So, I mean, it was interesting to see him in that way too.
Yeah, it was cool. Also, we played with Ben Roethlisberger who... he duck hooked one so bad off the first tee that I thought he was like a 20 handicap. Like, that was the first swing I saw him make. He birdied four of the next five holes. I think he made seven birdies over the course of the day. He swings at 124 miles an hour with 184 ball speed. And he drove a par four. He was hitting sand wedges into par fives. The guy absolutely murders the ball. He makes a lot of big numbers, but his game is quite impressive. So, I think that's pretty much all I had from Bay Hill. Do you want to get to some listener questions?
Sure.
Let's do it. Ty Ogden says, do you think Big Cat brings out more of Rory?
I don't think so. I mean, like, it doesn't that doesn't seem to make a ton of sense to me. I get where people could be coming from, right? I mean, if Rory may have been extra jacked up to play this week because he knew that Tiger was in the field, and that he knew that he was making a charge on the weekend and that he was going to be around. I don't see it. I mean, Rory could have done this exact same thing if Tiger was sitting on his couch playing Call of Duty this week. Like, I don't know. Like, it doesn't seem to me like that makes a big difference to me. I don't know. You might have more insight into that than me, but I don't think that makes a ton of difference.
I just found it interesting when I talked to him Tuesday. He was kind of like excited about it. He's like, "How about last week, man? I was like, that was pretty wild, huh?" I was like, "Yeah." I was like, it's pretty exciting stuff." And I made a comment to him like, "Yeah, you know, obviously it was kind of cool to see all the pros that were kind of rooting for him, but part of me is kind of like, guys, like, I mean, I know it doesn't have an effect on him, but like, I don't know if you necessarily want to be like rooting for him. This might be like a very real thing. That's very." And he kind of brushed it off like, "No, like, I'm not worried about Tiger." You know what I mean? He wasn't like intimidated, which is the right attitude to have. And I guess that's not like shocking news, but he's kind of like, "No, like, come on, this is really cool for the game." And so just for him, that he was that steadfast about being really excited about Tiger being back was kind of cool. And how he was still, and this was again, obviously before he won, still so confident in himself and almost unfazed by anything that anybody was saying about his game or anything like that. So I found that interesting that he was kind of like, "No, I'm still got this."
It's funny though. Like, it has been really interesting to see the reaction from the other players when you're like, when he's been playing well the last few weeks. You know, you'll sit on Twitter, as I'm sure, like I sit on Twitter and I'm watching the tournament, as I'm sure you do. And, you know, you'll see like the reactions from the other players that you follow who aren't either in the tournament or who missed the cut or whatever. You know, players like Tyrrell Hatton, who's like 14th or 15th in the world, and he's tweeting about how great it is to watch Tiger play well. And it's like, it's a surreal thing to like all these guys, like they're around our age or younger, and they all watch Tiger the way we did. Right. And it's like, you know, they're getting to see this. They're getting to see this again for the, you know, in probably in a way that they didn't think they would either. So it's been kind of cool to see their reactions to it, too.
It's amazing that you can still, as a Canadian, still root for Tiger Woods after what he did to Stephen Ames. I admire you for it. It's admirable.
Hey, listen, one of his best shot ever might be right near my backyard out of that bunker at Glen Abbey. So
his best shot ever was the first tee shot against Stephen Ames that day when he drove the green and twirled the biggest club twirl you could ever imagine.
Oh my God.
Gavin,
he hasn't recovered.
At time is Illmatic, kind of cool name. Is Jordan Spieth currently relevant?
Let's not
he didn't play this week one like
no exactly.
And we weren't ready to ring the alarm bells last week on him.
Look, I mentioned this right off the top, right? It's like there are probably 10 to 15 players in the world that you should never actually worry about, unless, like, over, you know, if somebody has like a span where they're just awful for like an entire year, then okay, it might be time to start thinking about these things. But until Spieth goes on some kind of run where he's missing cuts, you know, every week or whatever, I'm not worried about him at all. I think he's going to be just fine. And you know, as you've said, I believe you have him winning what 9, 10, 11 green jackets or something like that. I mean, he's going to be just fine. And if he wins in a couple of weeks, no one's going to be shocked.
I mean, along the same lines, the Nate89 asks if Spieth is still my pick for the Masters. And that answer is yes. I'm staying with it. I don't change. I make my picks in the beginning of the year and I don't change them. I stick with it. Yeah. Like I'll say it probably in five more podcasts leading up to the Masters that there's something about him in that place that makes me make that pick. So if I were to change it, it would be for JT, because I think JT is quite confident that he's going to win the Masters, I'm pretty sure.
Well, I mean, look, I actually don't think I've made a pick at any point over the last little while. It's hard for me to kind of go away from Justin Rose at this point. I don't know. It's kind of strange, but I mean, I'll say this though. I mean, if Rory's going to do anything similar to what he did today, then he's going to win by 10. So, I mean, it's hard for me to go away from Justin Rose at this point, but you know, Rory was always built for that place. Oh. So, not going to be surprised if he
takes me
either.
To Augusta now. Let's do this now.
Yes.
I'm excited for the match play though. Brian Evanson says, "Is this the most difficult year in history to qualify for either Ryder Cup team?"
That's a good question.
I don't know enough about history to say it, but in my lifetime, it certainly seems that way for both teams.
It, you know what, it feels that way. You know, you get to, I mean, as I'm sure, you know, you've gone over in your head repeatedly, you know, for, you know, things like the 2004, 2006 Ryder Cup team or whatever, like those teams were historically bad American teams, right? You know, and then even like the 2016 European team, you would say is probably not, you know, the best team that they've been able to put out. Even the 2014 European and American teams, right? Like, you look at some of the players that are on those teams, you know, like, no offense to some of these guys, but, like, have you thought about Stephen Gallagher since he played there? Like, have you, like, Jamie Donaldson, is, you know, hit one of the shots of the tournament that year, but, like, he hasn't really done much since. Victor Dubuisson hasn't really done much at all since either. You know, then, you know, look at some of the American guys, like, oh, I think Mahan was on that team, Webb was on that team. So, I mean, it strikes me that it seems like, you know, again, maybe these guys were looked upon differently than I recall back then, but it feels like these are the deepest rosters that I can remember in a long time.
How dare you besmudge the name of Brett Wederich? I'm offended. No, it definitely does, and it's I don't know. I love doing the exercise of, this guy was on that team. It's crazy. And even guys on the 16 team are like, all right, we can definitely scratch that name off. You're not going to be on the 18 team. But here's a good one from Ginger Sports. Go ahead.
There was talk, if you recall, back in 2014, I believe, of if Bernhard Langer was actually good enough to make that European team.
I think it was in 16 even, wasn't it?
Maybe it was in 16. Who knows? I mean, maybe it could be this year.
That might
be
why the U.S. won that one, because maybe Bernhard Langer was a candidate for it. Ginger Sports asks, what's happening with Smiley Kaufman this year? Another terrible performance and a miscut.
I was looking this up randomly the other day, and it seems like he's on some kind of run where he's posted tournaments in the 80s, rounds in the 80s, and like four of his last five starts or something. Like, it's so strange. I don't know. It's really bizarre. I mean, I would have thought, I don't know what, was he looked upon as like one of these like up and coming players that we should have been paying a ton of attention to? Like, I'm trying to like wrap my head around it, to be perfectly honest. Yeah. Like, I know that like he wasn't supposed to be like some, you know, Spieth, Rory level like kind of guy, but like he was supposed to be better than this, if I recall.
Yeah, so Tron wrote about this in the in our mailbag as well, and Ryan Lavner has a great piece also on the Golf Channel, just about, you know, talking to Smiley and getting some answers as to what's going on. But no, he was not projected to be a great player. He had a great year as senior year. I believe he was first team All-American when he was a senior, but was averaging essentially 74, 75 in several seasons leading up to that, and won on the Web Tour when he came out, and then got hot and won in Vegas, and still has his exemption from that. I mean, if you remember, he was in the final group of the Masters in 2016. Yeah, I think it was.
Yeah.
And has not been the same since then. So, no, he was not this kind of top-caliber player. He gets put in this bucket because of, obviously, the guys he goes on spring break with, which is, you know, that's a golf media production more so than it is a that you can fault him for it. But he was pretty open and honest with Lavner about stuff he's working on. And, I mean, he's lost it it's very badly. I mean, it's going very poorly. I don't know. I look at it, though, and just kind of think – I respect him for going out there, like holding his head high and facing it, knowing that, you know, people are snickering, people are saying things, and he hears it, the crowd and whatnot, and he's, you know, still out there grinding at it. And plus, it just makes you appreciate, you know, the guys that are able to compete week in and week out for how hard the game is. Like, it just shows you that, you know, professionals lose it just as fast as, you know, you can play a great round one day and lose your swing the next day. Like, that's how it works with some professionals as well. I see people adding him on Twitter and like talking about shit talking
Don't do that.
Like, the guy's going through some struggles. Obviously he wants to play better. Like, I don't know. It's a tough part of the game. It's tough to watch somebody go through it. He's a really nice guy. Guy I definitely root for, and ready to kind of see things turn around for him. So
if anyone listening to this is one of those people, don't be one of those people. Don't add him.
I think he'll come out of it. He's shown some flashes, and then it just disappears. But, I mean, it's all aspects of his game are a big struggle right now. But I felt more optimistic after listening to or reading Lavner's piece. So, did you pick out any other questions?
So, like, there was one that was interesting here about. Basically about if we could pick our ideal groups, our last few groups at Augusta. I mean, then we might have already kind of covered on that, but, you know, did you have any thoughts on that?
No, I mean, like I said, it's one of the the kind of the more ridiculous feeling things to do every year leading up to it. Like, of course we want Tiger, we want Phil and all that. But now, again, things are trending the way they are. It's kind of like, yeah, like let's power rank this. I'd love to. But it's, I mean, obviously it's going to be Tiger 1. I think Phil 2. I think a Tiger Phil showdown in their 40s would be fascinating. And but I mean, among the young guys, Rory is the most intriguing. And then yeah, we barely talked about DJ on this podcast. Barely, we talked a little bit of Spieth. We barely talked about JT. I think Rose just gets criminally overlooked by myself, by everyone. That guy is so freaking good, and he's just because he's not the longest and he's not the sexiest name or whatnot. Like, it would surprise me none if he was right up there in contention too. So. Oh, I don't know. I'm super pumped for these Texas events and all this stuff leading right up to it, man. I'm real, real fired up for it. So
there's also, I don't have the name offhand, but somebody had asked, do you think golf will do a made for TV primetime event this year or next, like Battle of the Bighorn? If so, who would play and what was the format?
I think we may have even discussed this on this pod. I think those events are kind of dead. They were cash grabs back in the day when, you know, tournament purses were still growing and a lot of things were getting figured out. I don't think people would really watch it as much as we think that they would. I just don't see the production costs that go into it and lining up a sponsor for that. And I mean, part of like what makes tournaments appealing to sponsors and whatnot is that they can, you know, bring clients to them and, you know, play in pro-ams and have amazing opportunities for networking and whatnot. And that doesn't really exist for a sponsor of a one night primetime event. So, I don't know. I'd be surprised if it ever came back. I know they tried to revive it with Ricky and Rory and that got canceled. Like that got canceled for a reason. Yeah. I don't know what it is, but I mean, that's kind of a sign to me that that's not gonna come back. So,
Get some wolf hammer
going
somewhere.
That would be interesting. If you want to do like a half-baked idea, we got a few of those. But Tucker Blankenship asked a good question. Rank the closing stretch of holes of the three Florida events. Thank you, Bay Hill, for not naming your closing stretch. Just thank you so much.
Yeah. No. Thank you.
Bay Hills is pretty exciting.
Bay Hills the best.
It's exciting.
Right?
Like, they give you the birdie hole. Yeah. It's one of the best birdie holes on tour. And they tough par three coming back and a pretty tough par four as well, finishing hole. So that's a good litmus test, I think. It's like you get one last little go at it here on 16, now figure it out coming in on 17, 18. That's probably my favorite, I would think, just because it's a good mix. I mean, like, Innisbrook is tougher, right? The Bear Trap is not – I mean, I shouldn't have even said it. The closing stretch at the Honda – is not that interesting to me. I mean, just because it's kind of carnage. I mean, they do finish with the birdie hole there. That's a good finishing hole. But I think Bay Hill's probably the best, right?
Yeah, no, it is by far.
All right. On that note, that's an hour. Sarson, thanks for your Sunday night. I got my Mountaineers here tipping
Thank
off
you.
Here in 3 minutes. So I was trying to run this up as close as I could before that happened. So I hope
sounds
good. If they lose this game, which this podcast will already be out by the time that's over. My family is going to be quite divided between West Virginia and Marshall. It's going to be ugly. So I'm a little nervous right now, so I'm ready to get it going. So Sarson, appreciate the time, buddy. And, we'll speak soon and, let's enjoy the match play. I'm excited. We didn't talk about the match play, but it's going to be a good week.
Okay. That's fine.
All right, buddy. Take it easy, man.
All right.
Cheers.
Thanks, man.
Be the right club. Be the right club today.
Johnny, that's better than most.
How about him?
That is better than most. Better than most!
Expect